Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is New York State Assembly Minority Leader William Barclay. He's a leader, a Republican who represents the 120th Assembly District. Leader Barclay, always great to have you back. You are terrific. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we love to have you on because we are true believers in all voices having a chance. Well, Andrew Cuomo's in a lot of trouble. Multiple scandals, nursing home death counts, sexual harassment allegations, seven women now, and the latest preferential COVID-19 testing for his family members. So, what do you think? He says he won't resign. There are those people who are, you know, saying one thing or another. I'm very interested in what your compatriot on the other side of the aisle, you know, the speaker, Speaker Hastie, is saying or doing. I can't figure out whether he's trying to help the governor or hurt him. What do you think?
Well, it is a little hard to tell, but, you know, personally, I thought in our, I think the majority of my conference, not everybody in our conference, thought he ought to resign. And then when he came out and said emphatically that he was not going to resign, we thought impeachment was a proper, avenue forward, just because we're concerned about how he can govern. You know, Dr. Chartok, we have some incredibly big issues that have to deal with in the state. We're still dealing with a pandemic. We have the budget issues, and the budget has to be done by April 1st. And it's very hard when you have a governor that's so politically wounded, you know, wonder how he can govern. But the speaker, you know, one thing we called on early on, we thought there should be an investigation, although we have the attorney general investigating, we have the Department of Justice allegedly investigating. We didn't think the legislature should just sit on the sidelines. We thought an investigation by the assembly was a proper thing to do. So I'm heartened that the majority listened to us and it started the impeachment proceedings through the Judiciary Committee, which we want to make sure that that's not a whitewash. And I don't have any reason right now to think it will be, but we want to make sure that that's, you know, moves along at a good pace. We don't want it just to, you know, sit on our hands here and have the, you know, the governor not be accountable to that committee.
Can I ask you a question? It's a personal favor. Would it be possible to get you to call me Alan as opposed to Dr. Chartok? I keep looking around.
I'd be happy to do that. If you call me Will, and I'll call you Alan.
Okay, great.
Great.
So let's take a look at some of these things. Of all the allegations that are being made against the governor right now, which is the one or ones that you think rise to the top of the list?
Well, I think obviously the harassment claims against the governor are troublesome. The hostile work environment that he apparently had is troublesome. But the one that I think concerns me the most, although they're all troublesome, is the nursing homes cover-up. As you know, this is a year anniversary of the March 25th order that he allowed COVID-positive patients to go back into nursing homes. And as a result, we found out that, you know, people died as a result of that, tragically. And we can even forgive maybe bad policy decisions on that. But the fact that he covered that up, and he had his top aide say we froze, and we didn't want to give that information out because we were concerned about the political fallout. We were concerned about a potential investigation. I think that is really troublesome because, you know, we're trying to deal with this pandemic. And when you're not getting accurate reporting from the second floor, who's in charge at that time, how can you craft good public policy without getting the accurate facts? So that one, I think, is particularly egregious, but I think all these claims against the governor are troublesome and need to be fully investigated, and they have to have accountability, ultimately.
So I don't get it. Okay, so he says that he had advice that he should send people who are in hospitals back to their nursing homes. And even his top aide is now saying we didn't quite tell everything that we knew at the time. So what's the major problem here?
Well, you could say, I mean, what's the crime in doing that?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking me?
Yes.
Well, you could, I don't know specifically what crimes, or there certainly could be an abuse of power issue. There certainly could be a potential, a cover-up. And then, as I said, how do you craft public policy on that without providing the legislature and others with accurate information? I think it's pretty problematic.
So what if he just sends, you know, a lot of people have been saying he can't negotiate a budget. He's wounded. But what if he sends his people into the room and has them do it? Is that a no-no?
Well, you would hope the man in charge would be the one that would ultimately be negotiating the budget. Obviously, staff plays a role in anything we do, but ultimately someone's got to be the decision maker. In the end, and we, as I mentioned, we face really incredibly difficult budgetary time, although we did get the $12.5 billion from the federal government, which helps a lot. But, you know, I was hoping if the governor had more power, I probably would agree with him more on the budget issues than I would with the majorities in either the Senate or Assembly. The last year's budget was something like $192 billion. The Assembly majority is looking to get that budget up to $208 billion. And just to provide a little perspective on that, California, which, you know, you could classify as a tax and spend state, has twice the population as New York. Their budget is something like $200 billion. Florida, which is 24 million people, 25 million people, their budget is $92 billion. So when we're talking about $208 billion that the Assembly majority is proposing, I would hope you'd have a strong governor that would say, look, that's not appropriate. We already tax and spend way too much in New York State. We need a little sanity in this budget process. But my concern is he is so politically weakened that he'll get rolled by the majorities in the Senate and the Assembly.
And the big issue between them, I think, is whether to raise taxes, isn't it?
Yeah, I was heartened that the governor said he didn't think that was necessary. But as you know, the Assembly majority is proposing $6.8 billion in new taxes.
Yeah, and I take it your conference is dead set against that. The governor says he's against that, but if he's so weakened, do you think it'll happen?
I think it's possible. My guess if you want my political analysis,
I do.
I think it's very important to get an on-time budget for him so he can show that he is being effective. And I think in order to get an on-time budget, he might be willing to cave on issues like taxes and spending. So that's my concern on that.
I don't think he ever really wanted, this is Alan speaking now, he really wanted a Democratic Senate because he knew what was going to happen.
Right.
When that happened, they were going to be out of control because he's a moderate and they're not. So it's interesting. Okay, so let me ask you this. Your conference has called on him to resign. It looks to me like he's not going to do that. He says he won't do it. I don't think he will do it. And I don't see any real rationale, maybe you can supply it, for why he should resign. In other words, if he stays put and it goes on and on and on, these investigations, you know, he sees it to the end. How would you, as a Republican, try to get him out of there?
Well, I think the only way you can, clearly he's been emphatic about not resigning, is through an impeachment process. And so I am happy that we've started that commission, you know, through the Judiciary Committee, started those hearings. And I hope we have a strong voice in those. That's the only thing we're concerned in the minority, that somehow we won't have a strong voice and we won't have access to whatever the investigation is finding. We just don't want it to be a whitewash. And I have no indication at this time that it will be. I was pleased at the opening part of that hearing to hear the chairman talk about how they're going to be doing the investigation and how it is going to be open to all members of the Judiciary Committee. And I hope we're going to hold them to that word. The other thing is, as I said before, I just don't want it to be delayed, because I do think, you know, all going back to my original point, I think the governor, because of he's politically weakened, I think his ability to govern and do what's right for New Yorkers is severely hampered by it. That's why I would like to see him resign, but obviously he's not willing to do that.
I don't think he'll do that unless somebody comes up with something that would make him. What about the state health commissioner, Dr. Howard Zucker? Should he resign? Should he be impeached? I mean, what do you do?
I think he ought to resign. But I don't want him to be used as a, as an scapegoat on this, because ultimately it's got to be the man in power. We gave the governors, you know, extraordinary powers during this pandemic, and we hoped you'd use them appropriately. I think he made a lot of mistakes on that. But should Zucker, I think he ought to resign. I think he is culpable on this circumstance. But I don't want the governor to say, well, he's the one that made the decision and he's got to go. I think the governor ultimately has to be accountable for these decisions.
Will Barclay, give me insight into how, if you did actually get impeachment going as a process, what would happen? How does it differ from the federal impeachment operation?
Well, my understanding on the assembly side is very similar to what it would be in the federal, like the Congress. We draft the articles of impeachment and present them to the Senate. The Senate's a little different because you have, obviously, the jurors are the senators, but also the Court of Appeals judges, the nine judges on the Court of Appeals. So that changes the jury pool, I suppose, a little different than would be on the federal level. The other thing that's not really clear, obviously, there's not a lot of precedence for this. The last time we did impeachment was 1913. So I think a lot of the stuff would be de novo. You know, it'd be new. We wouldn't know exactly, like, who's going to prosecute the case. Would it be assembly members? Would it be attorneys, you know, hired by the assembly? Those types of questions I don't think are clear. I don't think there's any precedent. So to some extent, we'd be breaking new ground if we end up getting that far. I think, though, ultimately, if this investigation by the Judiciary Committee turns out that they, you know, find that these offenses that the governor is being accused of rise to the level of impeachability, then I would suspect that kind of pressure, the governor might reevaluate, you know, whether he's going to resign or stay in office.
Now, there's almost no one who seems to think he will actually run for that fourth term he was said he was committed to. But I think he might. I mean, the guy's got a lot of chutzpah in him. And it would all come down, right? It would all come down to whether or not the Republicans, you guys, can find a suitable candidate to run against him. Remembering, of course, that nobody thought Mario could be beaten, his father. And he was, by George Pataki. So what do you got?
Well, I am happy, as I think I talked when last time we talked, I have been in contact with a number, I would say, leading elected officials and non-elected officials. Republicans in the state are interested in running. So I'm optimistic, although I'm new to this position, I haven't gone as leader, gone through a gubernatorial election. I would say, just in my experience, this has been the most interest we've had from Republicans running since, you know, a long time. So I'm optimistic. I think, you know, the governor's going to face, even if he did run again, he's going to face, I think, some problems within his own party to secure that nomination. So he's going to have to get through that and then obviously survive any challenge that we can give him.
But could you give me some names? I mean, we'll, you know, just between
well,
us.
Not,
nobody's listening.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah.
Just give me some names.
Well, they're not. I'm happy to. They're not. I don't think they're mysteries. I think they've admitted they're invest, you know, looking at the race. You got a guy like Lee Zeldin from Long Island, the congressman. There you have Mark Molinaro. There's Elise Stefanik that's been talked about. So those are some of the, you know, four people in the forefront that I think are considering it.
You don't really think Elise Stefanik could beat Andrew Cuomo, do you?
I think there's a good shot that any Republican, a better shot than a long time, that Republican win it. I don't know if I mentioned. I mentioned Molinaro too. Mark Molinaro.
You did.
Ran against
you did.
Last
and
time.
He got lost the last time, right?
He did, but he got 2.1 million votes. I think it was the highest vote count of a Republican has gotten in a long, maybe ever. So when that was when the governor was very strong, obviously in this weakened state, and if he runs, I think there is a good shot for a Republican to win.
Okay. Have you been vaccinated?
I got it yesterday.
Did you? First one?
Yeah, just the one. Yeah, I got it just yesterday. And, you know, I'm 52, so I qualified. And they had a clinic right here in the legislative office building. So I went down and got it.
Yeah, and so you'll have to take one more shot?
No, it's just one shot vaccination.
Oh, you're Johnson, Johnson?
Yeah. Yep.
Interesting. So there are a lot of variants coming along. Are you worried about this whole thing, you know, eating us all up?
The COVID or the vaccination?
Yeah, COVID. The COVID.
COVID. Well, I'm hoping we're moving through the pandemic. The more people get vaccinated, hopefully it will protect us and we can start moving out. I'm heartened to see that the numbers of infections and fatalities from the COVID are continuing to fall. So let's hope that and we can get back. I think everybody's anxious to get back to life as normal.
You know, there are a whole bunch of anti-vaxxers. I hate to say it, but I think more Republicans than Democrats. Are they being stupid?
I think it has to be an individual choice. but I happen to think it's a wise choice to get vaccinated. I encourage everybody to get vaccinated. What I don't support, though, is mandating the vaccination. I don't think that's necessary. And as far as I can tell, that I think I haven't heard, you know, a large movement out there, not, you know, large that would cause maybe health concerns of people not getting vaccinated. So I think we just got to keep doing it. I think we lead by example, and I was happy to get vaccinated, and I think it was the right move from a health perspective.
So, Will Barclay, one of the things that we're hearing now is the legal. There's a deal on the legalization of recreational use of marijuana. Can you tell us about what that's going to be?
We'll see. I guess that's what I understand. There is an agreement, although we haven't seen any bill text on it. There was a question about how to tell if someone was driving under the influence of marijuana. I think that was one of the holdups. Obviously, whatever revenue that's generated by the recreational sale or sale of recreational marijuana, how that revenue is going to be used. And the expungement of people's criminal records, I think, was a somewhat controversial. But as I've said to you before, I oppose the legalization. I just think it's in a step in the wrong direction. You know, we've had anti-smoking campaigns in this state forever. It seems odd to me that we'd go back and now, you know, try to open up and allow people to smoke marijuana. This seems contrary to everything we've been trying to do. And we certainly have the opioid crisis. We have plenty of drug problems in the state. Why are we going in this direction and legalizing something that doesn't need to be?
Well, you're talking to somebody who has never, I mean it, you know, people laughing on the other end of the phone, has never had any marijuana. So I used to tell my class there, this bearded professor, then I used to stand up and say, I've never smoked marijuana. And the whole class would start to clap and laugh. I don't know why. Maybe there's something in my personality that made them think that. Okay. So was the minority included in this discussion about how to do this? Or I take it from your past remarks just a few seconds ago that you were not.
No, we didn't have any input on it. But as soon as we see the bill, we'll be able to opine on it. And I would guess when the bill comes through, it's my understanding it's going to be done outside the budget. I'm sure our conference, although I don't know, I haven't polled our conference where they are. I would suspect a majority of us are opposed to it, but we would debate it fully when it came to the floor for a vote.
I'd really love it if you would, Will, if you would just say to your group sitting around that big table in your conference room, could you all just raise your hands if you ever smoked marijuana?
You want me to do that, and I'll report back to you.
Can you? That would sure. Be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
I'll see okay. What the outcome is before I report back to you, though.
And how do you deal? Well, and you say, but this is what we call an honesty question, meaning if you lie, a lightning bolt will come out of the sky and hit you in the head. Okay.
Well, even Go though, if, let's say, you know, I think there's no, even if you had, I mean, we're getting a little bit off topic here, but if you had smoked marijuana, that doesn't mean you have to support legalization of marijuana. Maybe if you're a regular smoker of it or something, you might support it, but I don't think it makes you, I mean, we have a lot of laws that unfortunately people break from time to time. And just because that's the case doesn't mean you can't vote on it or have an opinion about it.
Now, you mentioned the idea of driving while marijuana intoxicated. How do you deal with that?
I know they have special training for law enforcement, but that's, I think, again, is one of the reasons of the sticking point. My understanding in this bill, it kind of punts it down the road a little bit, and they're setting up a marijuana commission that's going to investigate that exactly. But I have no idea how you measure. My understanding, again, with marijuana, there's different levels. And you could be, you know, higher on some marijuana versus others, and guess how much you smoke. And that could cause impairment, but I don't think there's any way of measuring. Like alcohol, you have the blood alcohol levels that you know how much someone's drank, and obviously the more they drank, the more impaired they are. I don't know if there's that same type of measurement with marijuana.
Former President Trump continues to hold a very iron-like grip on the party, your Republican Party, but many more moderate, old-school Republicans don't think he represents the values of the Republican Party. What do you think?
Well, I think he's no longer president anymore, and I think people that want to use Trump against Republicans keep trying to bring him up. But, you know, he does have influence as a former president, but whether he's going to be the main decider of how the Republican Party goes forward, I don't think that's probably the case. So, you know, we'll see. But I don't think his influence on the party is as strong as maybe some people make it out to be.
Are you worried about redistricting in the state? You know, there's always been the gerrymander, the Democrat. Let's face it, the Republicans in the Senate have always been able to, you know, basically survive until it was too late. There just weren't enough bodies. So what's right. going to happen with redistricting now?
Well, I am very concerned. You know, we did do a constitutional amendment to try to form this independent redistricting commission, and then that fell. It's still there, but unfortunately, it hasn't been funded. I was pleased. One of the few things I'm pleased with the Assembly One House budget proposal is they do provide funding for that independent redistricting. The problem that we have, as you're well aware of, is our time's running short. We have to get these districts in place in time for next year's the 2022 legislative elections. And the longer we delay on this, the harder it is to get those lines doing. So I am concerned, and it's always been a problem for the minority in the Assembly. We always seem to be on the short end of the stick when it comes to redistricting.
How would it work, Will? I mean, in other words, what happens? You sit down and you draw districts. And if the Democrats wanted to do damage, which I'm sure they do, to the Republicans, even further than being in the minority now, could they hurt you?
Yes, very much so. Although, interestingly, we've been through so many different redistricting. Some of the districts now, it's hard to find Democrats to put in. That's why a lot of the Republican districts have become more and more Republican, because they shave off, you know, Democrats make stronger districts for the Democrats. But ultimately, yes, whoever draws those districts can do great damage. And we've seen what's happened in the Assembly. Now we're probably going to see what happens in the Senate.
Now, you've been a prime sponsor of cyber terrorism. What can you tell us?
Well, I do think there is a concern with cyber terrorism, and we have to. The only caveat I've had this week, interestingly enough, Alan, was Small Business Week here in Albany, and actually cyber terrorism and data protection came up in all my discussions with these small businesses, because they're worried about potential mandates that may come down, particularly with, I think, the governor's proposal, and there's a proposal in the Assembly that really are onerous on people and small businesses and what they have to do to protect, you know, their customers' data. So although I think it's a real concern, and I think we ought to put some protocols in place to protect people's, you know, personal data, I just think we can't go overboard with it and make it so onerous that, it's tough for businesses to comply with whatever the law is that we pass.
Will Barkley, talk to me about police reform. Communities across the state are submitting their plans. The governor required them to. What are you hearing? Are we going too far? Are we hampering the police? Do we need to do more? What's the deal?
Well, I think what we've discussed in the past on your show is I wasn't, unlike maybe some others in the party, I wasn't overly as troubled with the governor's requirement, because I was happy that at least it wasn't coming from top down. It was supposedly done by the local police departments. They come up and get consensus on this, and then they implement their own plan. So from that perspective, just general governance, I think you end up getting better product by going from the bottom up versus, you know, being mandated from the top down. So I've heard some good things. I know locally where I am, Oswego County, the Oswego Police Department, the city of Oswego Police Department, have come up with a plan. I think it's been relatively well received. All that, though, goes back to, we have a serious, serious issue in New York State, obviously, with the increased criminal activities, with violent crimes. We have the problem with the raise the age issue. We have the problem with bail reform. And as a result of these policies that have been put in place, we're seeing an increase in crime. And I think that is very, very troublesome. And the reforms that the governor required them, police departments to do, are fine. But I don't think that's going to get to the real problem that's causing this increase in crime.
Yeah. Well, and in order to put a lid on some of that crime, is there anything you'd like to see done specifically?
Yeah, well, I think one thing is we got to hold people accountable, and we just can't let criminals out of jail, particularly violent criminals. That is the problem with the bail reform. If people commit these crimes, and granted, they're not all violent crimes, and they're just released from custody, and you're seeing them go back and repeat criminal behavior. And the same, unfortunately, raise the age, the same thing. And I think we talked about, they did a great story in the TU about following some of these juveniles that because they can't put them in any kind of institutional setting, their recidivism and crime is skyrocketed, and it's causing real hurt in neighborhoods, particularly urban neighborhoods.
So let's stay on police for a while. In the end, mayors have a great deal to do with who becomes the police chief in their town. Do you think there's a difference in Republicans and the way they handle police and Democrats?
Well, I don't know. I think ultimately mayors are interested in getting reelected, and I think if they have huge crime rates in their cities, that's going to be hard for them to get reelected. So I'm not sure the concern I have is over with Republican or Democratic mayors and who they choose as police chiefs are. I think my concern, again, goes to kind of policies that we're passing here in Albany that let dangerous criminals back on the street to recidivize. And that's I think, the real problem here, and that's why you're seeing a spike in crime.
I see that you're writing an occasional column here and there, Will Barclay, and do you find crossing over into the journalistic realm is helpful to you?
I do enjoy doing the columns, and it helps let people, you know, put my thoughts and let people know what we're trying to accomplish and where we're trying to push back on the majority. That's the vehicle we use. And I've told my conference, and I've told anyone to listen, when I became leader, we're going to try to use any bully pulpit we have to hold the majorities and the governor accountable, and we're going to push back when we think they're instituting bad policy. And the column's one way I do that.
And another way is we get you to come on here, for which I want to thank you. So,
thank you.
You are terrific to come on and be with us. So thank you so much, Will Barclay, and so much for this program. But we'll have you again and again. And if you'll come, we'll be delighted. So thank you so much.
Great. Good talking to you.
Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.